Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Welcome, everyone. Anybody here for the first time tonight? Welcome, welcome, welcome. Bunch of folks for the first time. Welcome to anybody who's joining us for the first time online. Hi, Mom.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, Noah.
I'd like to start by asking you to talk to each other for a moment, because a core part of Buddhism is developing connections with other people that are trying to practice this path. It's called the Sangha. Sangha is the word for community or fellowship, or sometimes it was talked about as developing relationships with wise people, people who are at least trying to be wise, who are on a path to wisdom. So what I'm going to talk about tonight, so I'd like to give you a topic for these small group icebreaker meet people. I'm going to talk about, in some ways, the way that I would think about Buddhism, all of Buddhism is about how do we get free from suffering. How do the definition of enlightenment or awakening is coming to a experience where we no longer create suffering, unnecessary suffering for ourselves in our life. And although these two things go together, I'm going to separate them for the sake of the talk tonight and the topic, which is in order to end suffering, we can either learn non-attachment to pleasure and compassion. And so through meditation, we can develop compassion as a skill, learning to meet our pain with compassion, and we can learn to let go, have non-attachment, non-clinging to pleasure. This is very counter to our human instinctual tendencies to be kind to pleasure rather than aversive towards it and non-attached to pleasantness rather than addicted to it. And the other side, and really these two go together, but I'm gonna separate it. The other side, or is we can learn the impersonal nature of the human condition, what the Buddha talked about as not self, not being so self-centered in a simple way. I'm gonna talk about that tonight, ways to be not so self-centered. And for the small groups, I'd like you to diagnose yourself and talk with each other on a scale of 1 to 10. How self-centered are you? Now, I do want to lead into that saying that from a Buddhist perspective, everyone is self-centered and it's not your fault. And becoming not self-centered is a skill, is a transformation that we humans have the ability to become less and less self-centered, less and less identified with our, maybe definition of self-centered is believing your mind and being identified with your views and your opinions. And, you know, like that thing that we all have where we're pretty sure that we're right about everything all of the time. Maybe some people have the opposite of that, of sort of a self-centered, low self-esteem, that is, where people are so self-centered that they're really sure that they're wrong about everything and everybody is smarter than them. And that's also a form of self-centeredness. But so the question is, how self-centered are you currently? Are you still at a 10? Or has meditation, spiritual practice, maybe recovery, psychotherapy, whatever it is in your life, that's given you some insight into not being so identified with your thoughts, your feelings, your views and opinions, with the I, me, mine tendency of the human condition that we all are in, that we're all sharing. So small groups, how self-centered are you? So finding a posture suitable, sustainable, for a period of about 30 minutes of sitting still in meditation. Mm-hmm. settling. Adjusting and softening, releasing any unnecessary tension in your body. Bringing an attitude of kindness, of friendliness. The intention to be patient and accepting of your experience in meditation. With each exhale, softening the belly, the shoulders, the jaw. Present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness, mindfulness of the experience that you're having right now, the experience of your body, sensations, the heart and mind, emotions, thoughts. The sense doors of sound, smell, taste, seeing. Spending the first few minutes of the sitting meditation practice with mindfulness of the breath, bringing the attention to the sensations the breath creates as it comes and goes. Trying to let everything else recede to the background, disengaging from the thoughts, directing your full attention to the breath. No need to breathe any certain way. Put most of your effort into awareness, into receiving, to paying attention. Let the body breathe its own natural rhythm, however the body wants to breathe. Each time you become aware that your attention has strayed, has wandered off from the breath back into thinking or somewhere else, just acknowledge that thinking or hearing or wherever your attention has gone. And then choose to return, come back to the breath, right? To the sensations created by the air exiting and entering the nostrils. Perhaps even noting in and out with each breath. You can continue the narrow focus, coming back to the breath over and over, or you can begin to expand, to become more inclusive of your whole body. Mindfulness of the body, present time, non-judgmental, kind awareness of the physical sensations being experienced here and now. Notice how the body breathes all by itself. The heart beats all by itself. The body feels the nervous system, the digestive system, all doing their job, feeling sensations. Each breath oxygenating the blood flow throughout the body. Just as the lungs breathe, the heart beats, the mind thinks, and so often we're drawn back into awareness of the thoughts about future and past. Being mindful, being aware of the natural process that's unfolding. Hearing and seeing, smelling and tasting, thinking and feeling. One of the meditation instructions that the Buddha encouraged in mindfulness is to be mindful of yourself, your experience, as the four elements. As you feel the breath coming and going, acknowledging, becoming aware of the air element. This body that needs oxygen to survive. Each breath, continuing life in the body. This body that not only breathes in and out with the lungs, through the nostrils or mouth, but the body itself is porous. The skin breathes. and investigating, becoming aware of the temperature, the heat element, fire element. The direct feeling of temperature, and also the awareness that the average temperature of these human bodies is 98.5 degrees. Contemplating that we live in a hot body, almost 100 degrees, 98 and a half, all the time. How do you experience the earth element? What feels solid? Imagining your skeleton sitting here in meditation. The skeleton surrounded by flesh and blood and skin, organs. And the flesh and blood and organs filled with fluid, the water element. I believe it's close to 80% of the body is water, is salt water. Using the brain, the mind, rather than to plan the future, remember the past, to contemplate the present, to contemplate, to investigate the four elements in your direct moment-to-moment experience. reflecting on this brain, this skull, this bone, earth element, head and face, holding this gelatinous, mostly liquid, wrinkly brain. With all of its neuropathways and ability to be creative and to remember, to plan. The brain, too, is just the four elements, the water and air. Heat, earth, bring attention to the back of your skull, the brain stem, top of the neck. Just reflect that there's this part of the mind, the amygdala part of the brain, that is that which is aware of pleasant and unpleasant and neutral, that has the almost instant reaction of fight or flight or freeze or fawn. Does it all by itself. It's the self-centered survival instinct. Present time, non-judgmental, kind investigation. Of the body, the elements. For the last couple of minutes of the sitting, you can let go of the effort to identify the four elements and just rest again with the awareness of the body breathing. All by itself. Hearing, thinking, feeling. Without any help from you. All by itself. this kind of mindfulness that includes contemplation and investigation and inquiry into what's happening directly in our experience will lead, if we, I don't know, practice it appropriately and investigate long term and longer periods of meditation and periods of silent retreat practice, it will lead to an understanding that so much of what's happening in our heart and mind and body is not that personal. You start to see how the body breathes all by itself and the mind thinks all by itself, and so many of the self-centered thoughts that we become identified with, when you start to observe it, you see like it's actually not that personal. It's just the mind being conditioned by survival instinct and past memories. One of the things that I feel is useful, has been useful for me, is some, you know, there's that, I don't know, common question of like, what are we doing here and what's the meaning of life? And I've found it very useful to reflect on evolutionary biology, to consider that, I mean, Buddhism, you know, most religions, most spiritual paths have some level of a creation myth, some story about creation, how it all began. God created us. Buddhism doesn't do that. Actually, the Buddha was asked many times, you know, like, what's the story? Where did it all begin? And he said, you know, I don't teach that at all. He said, I only teach that here we are, and if you're suffering, there's a way to not suffer. Not about, but it's pretty natural. I mean, I think if you're curious, your mind kind of goes like, well, how did we get here? How do we get into these self-centered, craving bodies? And he doesn't answer it. But I have found that considering scientific, you know, maybe it's pseudoscience, it's, I guess it's real science, biological, evolutionary process. But I find it useful to think about, and I invite you to do this with me, to think about, here's this planet in this massive, you know, system of planets and solar systems and galaxies, and there's this planet that what they say that it's in the Goldilocks zone, where it's not too hot, not too cold, and the only planet that we've found so far that actually, you know, caught so enough water and enough temperature, the four elements were correct here for life. And we're on this planet that's, how fast is it going? Somebody probably knows. It's like thousands of miles per hour. Like it's spinning and orbiting, and it's fucking hauling ass through space. And however many millions, I guess billions of years ago, you know, the conditions of the water and the earth and the four elements and the light and the heat, you know, the theory is, I guess the science is, that the, you know, single-celled creatures, that there was no, there was life, but it was like single-celled creatures that started to split into double cells, and the evolution became kind of like, our ancestors are tadpoles, these like little tiny tadpoles that became fish, that became, you know, that actually, we, you know, we're close to the ocean. You think that actually we are biologically related to fish, our DNA. That, you know, we like to, it's easy to think about, well, eventually they became land creatures, and there was dinosaurs, and there was chickens. Chickens are like the only ones that survive somehow. I don't know, like the reptiles, and then monkeys and apes, and you know, that are kind of closest ancestors with the evolutionary biology that kind of, you know, the fish came onto land and the land, you know, became all of these different species. And that eventually the Cro-Magnons and then the Homo erectus, and that over the last, you know, I don't know the math. I mean, I read Sapiens, but I don't remember. Did you read Sapiens? It's a really interesting read about the kind of history of humanity. And but however many millions of years of evolutionary biology that led to humanity. And rather than a story, you know, so for me as a Buddhist and a psychologist and a rationalist, atheist, this biological evolutionary process makes sense to me. Creation myths don't make sense to me, but the science of how, the psychology of how mindfulness and Buddhism works, and then the kind of science of evolution makes sense and helps me not be so, take everything so personal and be so identified with this human condition to see, like, oh, this is just the outcome of evolution, of biology, an impersonal survival instinct that is what we're experiencing. It's not personal, it's not self. It's not your fault. As I started with, like, how self-centered are you? I love the way Buddhism gives us the tools to do something about it, but also gives us the normalization that it's not your fault. It's not sin. It's not even neurotic, you know, trauma response, although it is that too. But that it's just not, you know, it's just in the process of evolution. I talked about in the meditation reflecting on the amygdala, the brain stem, they call it the reptilian part of our brain. That part of our brain that wants to run from pain or fight against it, or sometimes freezes. Or fawns, you know, that part that all by itself, we're not in control of it, it just happens. It's instinctual. That we're born with that. That is evolved as a survival instinct over the millions, billions of years of life on this rock that's spinning through space. And that I also think it's quite interesting to think of. I know this is I hate to even say it out loud, it feels so hippie, but talk about like Mother Earth. But that, like, this planet actually gave birth to us. Like, you know, like it really actually did. Like, it, but maybe we're more like a fungus that has grown out of this earth, right? Where we are the kind of, with the ecological devastation that humans are creating on the planet. You know, the planet created us. And now we're destroying it. You know, part of evolution is we have that survival instinct. And then we have this, I don't know, however many hundreds of thousands of years ago, but that we, you know, life developed into not just having a survival instinct brain, but having a big brain, a neocortex, consciousness. Consciousness, which is mostly self-centered, I, me, mine. I don't know if this makes sense to you, but I heard, and it made sense to me, that a lot of what's happening for humans is that there's the amygdala, reptilian brain that's doing all of the craving and aversion, and then there's the neocortex that's like assigning meaning. and sort of justifying our cravings and our aversions and our views and our opinions and our trying to make sense of it all, and creating religion, saying like, well, there's this is why. It's because God wants it, you know. This dude created us. Like, you know, the brain, that kind of trying to figure it out. Humans created religion, created myth, created stories in order to help us make sense of it. Stories that kind of assign meaning to what's happening here. I know some people might say, oh, well, evolution is also a story, and I'm open to that. Maybe it is a story. I'm not like, well, it's science, and I'm kind of like, well, it's a story that makes sense to me. Most of the other stories don't make any sense. Most of the religious stories to me kind of just seem so fantasy-based. Humans creating God in order to comfort themselves and saying, yeah, no, God created, we didn't create, God created us. Rather than, no, we assign that meaning to, we don't know what's going on here, so let's say there's a magical Easter bunny. So my sense, and I feel like, you know, connected with the Buddha's teachings, is that we, you know, however we got here, we're here, and we live in a self-centered, I, me, mine, meaning-making experience. Brain, mind, body. And there's all of this unnecessary suffering, all of the suffering of life without a wise relationship to the mind, to the body, to the emotions. If we let the craving, aversion, self-centered tendency of the evolved human condition, which is evolved on some level and not that evolved, it's still so, and then we look at the planet and like, this is, you know, evolution, where we're destroying the planet, we're waging war upon each other, always has been that way. From the beginning of time, as soon as, you know, humans started sharpening sticks and killing each other and creating metal and, you know, turning it into swords and spears and then bullets, then tanks, then bunker buster bombs, nuclear bombs. That kind of evolutionary craving, aversion, self-centered human condition that is just out of control with greed and hatred, resentment, sexism and racism and all of the phobias and all of the forms of oppression coming from unchecked brainstem activity, self-centered, fear-based, fight, steal, lie, cheat. It is the way it is. It is the world that we live in. It's what we're born into. Buddhism offers a really radical opportunity to drastically change our relationship to the natural human condition of ignorance, living a life chasing pleasure and running from pain and causing harm is normal, is the norm. Deciding to live a life where we're trying to be kind and compassionate and forgiving and loving and generous and creating a positive change rather than just chasing materialism and sense pleasures and is a radical choice. Is a choice that in the process of evolutionary biology 2600 years ago. One of the great things of the, evolution of the neocortex, the big human brain, is that we can train the mind. We can create neural pathways. Left unchecked, humans aren't very wise. The natural tendency of humans, without training and creating compassion and creating non-attachment and creating non-identification, that's a skill, that's a practice, that's a wisdom that has to be developed. It doesn't happen all by itself. And just because you're born doesn't mean you get to be happy. Happiness is not our birthright. We haven't evolved into mindful and wise beings. We've evolved into self-centered, harm-causing beings for the most part. And maybe within humanity, there's different levels of evolution. But in general, I heard one teacher reflect that, maybe eventually, how like we look back on our ancestors and like the, whatever, the Cro-Magnons or the cave, the early Homo erectus, they were like, fire. And we look back and I'm like, yeah, it's fucking fire, idiot. That maybe at some point, way down the line, people will look back at us and be like, people used to have to sit still and meditate, mindfulness. With that sort of, like we have to, like mindfulness is this, intense thing that we have to do, rather than perhaps if enough of us do it for long enough, there will be an evolutionary process of mindfulness. Doesn't look like the, planet's gonna host us long enough for that to happen. But if it did, if somehow, humanity survived and enough people were meditating for long enough, maybe we would be born with some self-awareness rather than self-centeredness, with some awareness that we don't have to obey the mind, that actually your thoughts and feelings and emotions are optional, are something that you can learn to respond to rather than react from. But in the meantime, it takes a tremendous amount. 2600 years ago, Siddhartha comes and he says, actually, if you pay close attention to the mind, you will see impermanence. And when you understand impermanence, you will see the importance of letting go, allowing impermanence, letting non-attachment. And when you see impermanence, and not just intellectually, but insight, wisdom into impermanence, you'll see that some of the pain in life is unavoidable, and the only wise choice is caring about it, is having compassion. It's the only thing that will allow us to not suffer about the pain. But that some level of pain has to be expected, expected and accepted. That there's no pain-free existence in this kind of nervous system process. It's not possible to not have pain. That's a given. One of the reasons I focused on the four elements in the meditation tonight is because I feel like this has been very useful to me to reflect, like, okay, this thing that I'm so identified with, this body and even my mind and my thoughts and my view, it's all just the four elements. As we meditate on it, and you say, like, it's just a 80% water, almost 100 degrees. It's just a hot bag of water. Walking around, taking the, firing thoughts from the watery brain as self. I, my views, my opinions, my thoughts, my feelings. This bag of water that's warm, has a little bit of earth element, very little carbon in the human body, even the skeleton, when it really dries out, turns to dust, there's not that much, very little solidity here, mostly water. And reflecting on and coming to understand ourselves as the four elements on this planet that is the four elements, surrounded by others who are the four elements, that when we really start to unpack it, we're just the four elements relating to the four elements. It's all that's really happening here when we're talking about what's true. It's one of the only things we can, the Dharma, sometimes we talk about taking refuge in the Dharma. The Dharma, which sometimes translates as the truth, but also translates as nature, the nature of things. And what is true and what is the nature of things is that this planet of the four elements created, the evolutionary process of humans, which are just more manifestations of the four elements. And it's something that we share with each other. It's also one of the ways some forms of Buddhism talked about interconnectedness and interdependence, non-separateness. And in some ways, as we understand the four elements as the basis of all existence, it's something that we all are, that we're all connected to, that we're all sharing, that makes us not separate from each other. That there's no, and this is ultimate, but in this ultimate reality of the Dharma, there's no race or gender or religion or age. There's just elements here existing. Now, on the relative level, race and gender and age and socioeconomic and political, all of that stuff is also happening. I don't want to dismiss it. And is very important in many ways. But part of what Buddhism is trying to help us to do is see how we suffer unnecessarily. And this is one of the perspectives. The more we can see ourselves as the elements and see each other as the elements, there's less reactivity. We can see our mind as the elements. Even this seemingly solid building we're sitting in, just the four elements, as you go and get in your car tonight or wherever you, just the four elements. Well, the sidewalk, there can be a split between the kind of city folks and the nature folks. People love nature. They're like, oh, that feels so good when I'm close to nature. Forgetting that actually concrete is also nature. Metal is also nature. All of it is the four elements, whether it's right angles that humans have created or combustion engines that we've created. It's all elements. It's all the four elements. There's no separateness. There's no difference between the tree and the sidewalk, or the building and the beach. Maybe, we feel a little bit more connected to having your feet in the sand on the beach than on the concrete, but concrete is just sand. Fucking hard sand. Sand and, you make concrete by sand, mixing sand and water and whatever else, and then it hardens and. One of the important things about being connected to a sangha and listening to teachings, studying, reading the books, doing all of that is that it does, it reminds us, it teaches us, and it reminds us, and it normalizes the human condition. And it gives us the directions, the instructions. Here's how to change your relationship to your mind. Present time awareness, mindfulness, investigation of the impermanent nature of things, we begin to let go. It becomes very practical responses turning towards pain, accepting pain, normalizing pain, developing compassion, turning towards the self-centered I, me, mine, meaning-making tendency of our mind with a little bit more healthy suspicion, skepticism. Maybe all of my views and opinions aren't true. Maybe it's not all about me all of the time. Maybe I don't need to take things personal in the way that I often do. Maybe that part of the reactive reptilian brain isn't so trustworthy. Mindfulness leads to that and loosens our identity with being this as our ultimate identity, seeing, oh, this is relative. Yes, I'm in a body, and this body is subject to impermanence and sickness and aging and death. This body craves pleasure and hates pain. None of it's personal. We talk about it with each other in the Sangha. We listen to the teachings. It helps us not take it so personal. Seeing ourselves as the four elements, seeing each other as the four elements. So some of my thoughts, and I'll open it to your questions about this or about anything else you'd like to talk about tonight. We have a little bit of time. Please.
Are we sure this has always been that we were meant to be suffering in this body and there has to be a war of all the things? Because I come from the Neolithic part of the world, which is Mesopotamia. And 12,000 years ago, the latest archaeological site shows no indication of a leader. It shows no indication of war.
No weapons or...
No weapons.
Yeah.
But they have hundreds of archaeobotanical findings that are now estimated to be all the legumes of the world, from all the parts of the world, started in Mesopotamia 12,000 years ago. And that 12,000 is such a great precision number because the German botanical laboratories only take plus or minus 300 years. So it could have been 30,000 years as well. Now we don't know. This is very new. It's just a decade of archaeological sites. It's just the only Neolithic part in the world.
Yeah.
This is called Mesopotamia. It starts in Turkey, where the two rivers are born. It's the land of the Bible, obviously, and goes all the way down to the very important parts of the world. Everybody is fighting for it.
Yeah.
And there was no indication of war. I just want to know.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I find that very interesting. Yeah, I don't, I have a sense that it's always been this way, but it might not have been. Who knows? And it's so hard with archaeology and history to kind of try to figure it out. Certainly, as long as people have been taking written histories, it's sort of a history of empireism and warism and greed, hatred, and delusion as humans, you know. And then, of course, you know, we have these sort of made up stories of the, you know, hunters and gatherers and killing each other, you know, and those sort of made up stories of the sort of different tribal conflicts from the beginning of time. But yeah, with you know, we only have recorded history for a few thousand years, so we don't know about 10,000 or 20,000 or 100,000 years ago what was really happening. So, but I'm not sure. I'm curious. I'm not sure how useful it is. To me, it doesn't feel very useful to be like, well, there was a time 20,000 years ago or 12,000 years ago where people weren't murdering each other left and right. Because for the last 10,000 years, they have been. And here we are where there's just, you know, we're on a kind of murder plane of existence and war plane of existence. And it's been happening for so many thousands of years now. Maybe it is useful. Maybe there is something we could learn from peaceful cultures. And I remember in grad school learning some stuff about that the matriarchal cultures were much less violent than the patriarchal cultures, and that there's definitely something about the male patriarchal cultures that have created the norm that we kind of inherit now, but that there were some matrial lineal cultures that were less violent. So in general, women are wiser than men.
Well, it doesn't mean that actually. A matriarchal culture means everybody has the nature of a good mother. How now in our culture, everybody needs to be competitive, you know, aggressive, get go, get it, do it, da da da. So back in that culture, you needed to be of the nature of a good mother
Loving.
to be somebody in the culture, or else you'd be excommunicated.
Right.
You've gone out of your tribe if you're a murderer, if you're not a kind person. That's how Buddha and people like him remembered how to be compassionate. There has to be a level of high compassion for us to still remember it. It isn't a skill, actually. A skill is learning to play a piano. But somebody knows how to play the piano. You cannot develop it on your own.
Not quite how I see it, but okay. No, I think I don't. My sense is I could be wrong, but my sense is that people aren't just born compassionate or not born compassionate. It's actually something that we're fighting evolutionary biology and a survival instinct, and the survival instinct is not very compassionate towards one's own pain. We hate pain. It's natural. You see children even raised by the most loving parents who still have strong aversion to pain and don't learn self-soothing compassion until it's a skill that they learn. Until so I see it as a very advanced sort of enlightenment path rather than some people are just are kind and some people aren't. Not stuck in that, but that seems to be what makes sense to me. Philip, go ahead and jump in.
So you were talking kind of about like how we create comfortingness and how when people ask the Buddha this stuff, he just kind of said like, I don't teach that. And I've heard like a debate on reincarnation, even amongst like some scholarly monks. Some say he did teach it, some say he didn't. And like it said that, like all of the Buddhist teachings fit in the Four Noble Truths. So, and I've not found a good answer to this. If the Buddha did teach reincarnation, where does that fit in the Four Noble Truths?
Could you hear the question in the room? Let me think about that. So the definition of nirvana is the end of rebirth. When he's talking about the third noble truth. And he's talking about ending the cycle of suffering, the cycle of rebirth. So I think that's the most direct teaching of reincarnation in the Four Noble Truths. But I also don't know, that's the way that you asked the question, Philip, of it's said that all of the Dharma fits in the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. I'm not sure that that's true, that that's. That was the first way that he formulated the teachings. And then over 40 years of teaching, he talked about his understanding in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different contexts. So I know that part of this question, I know that Philip, since you've been studying with me for long enough, I don't think it's important to believe in reincarnation, personally. I don't think you have to believe in it. But I do feel quite personally convinced in my study of Buddhism that it's definitely something that the Buddha taught. It's too embedded in all of the early teachings in so many ways that I believe that the Siddhartha, the Buddha, believed in a process of rebirth and impermanence of life and a karmic momentum that continued. And even just the way that he talked about what enlightenment is. He said, enlightenment is not having to keep coming back. It's freedom from the wheel of rebirth, of the deathless. So I do believe that he taught that, but whether or not you believe it, doesn't matter. Buddhism offers practical tools to have less suffering in your life here and now. And when you die, if reincarnation is happening, bonus, you'll get a better rebirth if you try to be a better person and develop more wisdom on this lifetime. And if it's lights out and there's no rebirth or there is some eternalism that you're gonna go to, still practicing the Dharma will help us both ways, whatever happens after this. It will give you a better life here and now. And then if there is some continued existence, you'll benefit from that then too. Is my sense. So not important to believe in, but does that make sense to you? The third noble truth is a teaching on rebirth?
Yeah, it does. I was trying to figure out whether it was that or maybe the first noble truth or, you know, but like, and I agree, like, I don't think it really matters too much whether there's reincarnation or not.
Anything else in the room, please?
So often you talk about having compassion toward our pain.
Yeah.
What does that mean in a practical sense? Like, how do you have compassion toward pain?
You know, the difference between resistance, or like, I don't know exactly, like some kind of compassion is a form of non-resistance. And that often when we have pain, there's this sort of like even tightening around it. And then compassion is a sort of opening of that tightening around it and just being, not resisting, not meeting, letting go of the aversion to it. Right? Pain hurts. And then when we meet pain with this emotional resistance, or sometimes even a physical tension, like you notice your belly getting tight or your jaw getting tight, and softening your belly and releasing your jaw or your fist or whatever it is an act of compassion, is an act of accepting. This is just unpleasant. And when I tighten around it, it makes it even worse. And when I try to resist it rather than accept the impermanent, unpleasant sensations. So tolerating it, not resisting it, is part of the process of practically developing compassion for pain. Ultimately, we want to get to a place where we don't only not resist it, but we meet it with a warm, friendly, caring, kind response, emotionally, of kind of like, oh, I'm in pain. Like, you know, like you can be compassionate to someone else that's in pain, and you'd be like, oh, really, I see that you're in pain, and I really care about you, and I'm here for you. Just maybe I'll just sit with you, or I'll just be here for you. If there's anything I can do to alleviate your pain, I will, but I also know I probably can't take away your physical or emotional pain, but I care about you. So you know that experience towards others, and then doing that for yourself. Oh, I care about, oh, fuck, I'm in a lot of pain. This really hurts. Rather than hating myself about it, or hating my body, or hating my mind, or hating my heart for being in pain. Non-resistance, caring, friendly response to it. Learning to be in pain in a wise way, in a friendly way, in a compassionate way. I do feel like there's such a process that happens, because aversion to pain does feel very normal, instinctual, right? The amygdala kind of stuff we're talking about. Hates, so our survival instinct is not compassionate. Our survival instinct is aversive. It hurts, fight it, run from it, freeze, get rid of it. Compassion's over here of like, oh no, it's, you know, like when it, there has to be some discernment when I say, you know, like if it is avoidable, like avoid the pain you can't avoid. When I'm talking about compassion, I'm talking about what do we do about the unavoidable pain? And that's part of the problem, right? Is because we tend to have a delusion that we think, wait, no, all pain should be avoidable. I shouldn't experience any pain any of the time. So if I just take these pills, then I don't feel shit. Or if I just, you know, that kind of feeling of all pain should be avoided rather than avoid the pain that you can, but also understand there's so much unpleasantness in life that's unavoidable. So much. Learn to have compassion, which is, you know, goes from aversion to acceptance, you know, intolerance with aversion, acceptance and tolerance with less aversion to maybe a place you've probably heard me talk about before. I like the, because the equation here is when we meet pain with resistance, we make it worse. We cause suffering. That actually, it happens all by itself. The untrained mind does that all by itself. But in some ways, it's saying you do have the power to cause yourself a tremendous amount of harm. You are very powerful. We are very powerful. You can make your life a living hell. A whole bunch of us have done it. You can really fuck shit up. You are a powerful person and have so much influence over how you and the definition of mercy is in a position where you have power to cause harm, abstaining from causing harm. So on the path to compassion, mercy, I feel like, has a very central learning to not make it worse. Note when you start to wake up and you say, like, oh, okay, my knee hurts right now, and I can hate it and turn it into some serious suffering and maybe even start worrying about I'll never walk again, I meditated for too long. And really, you know, creating some fear and some stories and some, or I can just relate to the sensation, oh, unpleasant, and be merciful with myself. Let me not make this worse than it already is. I have the power to make it worse. I have the tendency to make pain worse, to create suffering on top of it. And then getting to the, you know, and then the full compassion is not just, because mercy isn't necessarily loving, it's just abstaining from making it worse. And then compassion is actually soothing, as I care about this unpleasant sensation. I meet it with a loving attitude, with a warmth, with an open heart rather than I just don't hate you. I actually care about you. I care about this sensation or this emotion or this mind state. Maybe that's an okay place to end for tonight. Compassion's always a good place to end. Class is done by donation. Against the Stream is a nonprofit 501c3 that is fully dependent on your generosity. Obviously, I don't charge for class. I've been teaching this class for over 20 years, free of charge, completely supported by the generosity of the people who attend. So please be generous. The encouragement in Buddhism is to freely offer resources, donations to support this kind of conversation, this kind of practice, this kind of center that is here for you, the community. So at home, Philip, did you put a link in the, yep. So there's a link in the chat at home so you can click through and make a donation through the website. Here you can donate cash or there's Venmo or PayPal. Sebastian's at the desk. He can help you if you have any questions about how to donate. If you feel inspired and are in the financial ability to do it, please consider becoming a monthly supporter rather than this sort of fee for service of donating when you come. Just consider supporting Against the Stream as an organization, supporting this so that it's here, whether you come or not, so that it's available to people that want this and so that this kind of important conversation continues free of charge outside of the capitalist, monetization, just donation based. I've got a day long in August. That's, I think it's August 17th, a day of sitting and walking meditation from 9 a.m. until probably 3 or 4 p.m. That's on the Refuge Recovery website. I'm going to do it here and in person. You're all invited. It's a couple months away. And then I'm taking a group of people to Sri Lanka in the fall, November 10th through 24th, on a pilgrimage retreat adventure. We're going to do some surfing. We're going to pet some elephants. We're going to go to some ancient pilgrimage sites and ruins in this ancient Buddhist culture. We're going to spend 3 days in silent retreat during the trip. If you're interested, sign up soon and plan your two-week Southeast Asian, South Asian against the stream adventure with me and the Sangha. Against the Stream is supporting and, you know, encouraging people to get engaged politically, socially active in seeing how we can take our compassion off of the cushion and into our lives and into what's happening in the world, what's happening in our neighborhood, what's happening on our planet. George has been helping to organize that, and he's got some announcements.
Last month we got together, we made 100 sandwiches and passed them out on the beach. We also decided last month we're doing a sock drive. So if you have an extra dollar at the dollar store, grab a pair of socks or box here. If you could just donate socks to those houseless community, you know, foot hygiene is a real issue on the streets from what I understand. And so a clean pair of socks could really change someone's life. So bring a pair of socks in from the box. When we get the box full, we're going to donate them somewhere. Also this month, the center designed and printed flyers regarding immigration stops. There's a box of them on the front desk. Help yourself, take a stack, pass them out, nail them to the street poles in your neighborhood, leave them at stores, do whatever you can if you really know someone that could benefit. It's bilingual instructions, and there's a phone number for people if something has been apprehended. So help yourself to these. We have a monthly meeting that's going to be this Wednesday at 7 o'clock here in the center. Come join us. We're just, you know, we're just going month to month. We're trying to figure out our direction and what to do. And if you're interested in learning more, we have a WhatsApp group. Come find me after we close out, and I can add you to the group, and you can be informed on what's going on and how to get involved. Oh, and then also, we did the No King State protest. We had a good group going on there. That was pretty awesome. I know there's another No King State protest July 4th. Maybe we'll try to do something for that as well. Thank you.
Thanks, George. Offering the merit of our practice and discussion of the Buddha Dharma outward in all directions, shared with all living beings. May each one of us get as free as possible in this lifetime, and together may we create a positive change on this planet. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.